Do you want to have a few questions first?
Or
do
sure,
jump?
Yes.
I think what our plan is, we're going to jump to these groups and these sessions, but if there's any, quickly, some questions. If not, we'll move right to the group. So, yes.
In terms of brain growth, I've been interested to look at what kind of research is out there about habitat for birds, bees, butterflies, all of that. So two questions. One, have you seen much good research? And two, does that really depend on what you're planting on that green growth?
I think there's some really good research on that. There's I think it's an international green roof association. But a lot of times, I think green roofs will try to. I think it's all about establishing the goals at the beginning of what you want the roof to do, and then it can kind of go from there. So in other words, if the desire was to create a roof that was really going to attract butterflies or attract, more bees, and Kelty has some information about that kind of approach, then it can be designed to do that. But the most of the green roofs I'm familiar with have been more general in their goals. Mm-hmm. It's either about stormwater or it's just about creating a pleasant place to look, and so it could be more goal specific.
Attracting human habitat.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just more a comment than a question. It occurs to me that besides the habitat preservation goals and that sort of thing, a very important part of this is also the impact on humans, because it's always struck me that one of our biggest sustainability challenges is the reality that most of us have no sense of place. We're unconnected with our ecosystem, especially those of us who live in cities. And I think that's part of the whole bigger issue. We have no sense of place, so we have no sense that we have to preserve the place or that we have an investment in the place. And it always strikes me that this sort of thing offers that opportunity to city dwellers in a way that maybe hasn't been possible in the mm-hmm. past. And then all of a sudden the investment in preservation of place becomes important. So I think it's a bit of a circle. You know
mm-hmm.
what I mean?
Yeah.
Preserving habitat for the critters and the plants, all of that.
It's part of the community.
It mm-hmm. becomes it becomes sort of a cyclical thing that in the end will also hopefully be good for us.
Question back here.
Yeah, I appreciate if you guys have clients that are willing to do these types of projects and things, but I want to think back to what Jason was talking about earlier this morning about taking a bigger step towards that fuzzy goal, and again, how would we fit this into a regulatory framework to make that giant leap rather than sidestep an issue? It's been an issue of mine, having worked in both private and public sectors over the last 20-odd years, that we're running out of time, and I think we need to start pulling some of these into, the regulations that we have to deal with. City Seattle's kind of done that a little bit with their green factor, which is more of a landscape requirement more than an environmental mitigation type issue. But I think we need to start looking at this a little bit more seriously. I've dealt with citizens that have lived in a once rural area, get phone calls from them saying, hey, I love my new house, but I'm now having a bear look into my backyard, or I've got the farmer next door who's spraying manure on his fields and tilling his land, and the dust is choking me. So we've got to kind of start looking at, addressing these issues up front as part of the development, overall development review. and the especially the monitoring. You know, I love the monitoring component of looking at, you know, green rooms and things like that. But again, that also costs money for the owner of the building. But it also costs money for the city or county or state government to have staff that has the expertise to know what to look for. So I was wondering if I could get some suggestions from you too. How we move to get there.
All right.
I can speak to that a little bit. I work at Phillips Hervogs Mullenberg. I've been working on a Lower Dawn project in Toronto, which some of you might be familiar with. But actually, we've been doing probably about 5 huge redevelopment projects right on the waterfront in Toronto. And my familiarity with the regulations is much more expansive in Toronto than it is in Vancouver. There. I totally agree with you, and it's actually gone probably more to the extreme where there have been, almost every city department has developed a series of guidelines in terms of green development, guidelines that they are trying to get people to adopt. But the issue becomes then they have so many departments and so much bureaucracy between the departments that they're not communicating with each other. So what we end up with are situations like, there's the social housing advocacy groups who basically say there will be no underground parking within these structures because that's where the affordable housing comes in, is in the basement part of these structures. And then you have the other side of it where we're trying to get skinnier streets in these neighborhoods with, you know, maybe one side of parallel parking or no parking with most of the parking underground, and you end up with these kind of battles going back and forth, and what ends up happening is neither gets fulfilled, and you end up with the same old, because it's easiest. That's the only thing that people know how to push through. So I think in terms of Toronto, it's been public advocacy that's made that happen. It's been a lot of activism that has created that. You know, another issue, the bicyclists advocacy group in Toronto is extremely strong, and they've actually advocated and successfully pushed through that now every street in Toronto is considered a cycling street. Well, the problem with that is that that means that you end up with 4-meter lanes. So when we're trying to, again, get skinnier streets, less infrastructure, less asphalt, more tree space, more space for tree soils, we end up with minimum 8-meter right-of-ways on our roads, which is problematic. So I don't really have an answer for you, but I think it's public advocacy that will make that work and some sort of cross-department communication and collaboration that can help that.
So I have an easy suggestion to minimize that 8 meters, just get rid of the cars.
That's what we're trying to do.
All right.
I was just going to add one thing to that, is that I think the ESA is a great example of how regulation has had a huge impact, and that why that's important, because we've gotten so far down the road because of the Endangered Species Act and a lot of these issues. There are folks that are talking about doing eco credits voluntarily because say you're a polluter and your business is a polluter, you're polluting, but you're waiting basically for Superfund, federal money to clean up your site. Well, in the meantime, you could, you know, there's been conversations about forming consortiums of these industrial polluters that could actually create a cap system of, you know, we're going to lower our pollution output, and then we're going to trade among ourselves how that pollution gets distributed, and that's more beneficial for them. And the environmental community is a lot more excited because there's faster motion. So, I mean, because it's not tied up and it's a lot of the U.S. federal kind of issues. So that's an interesting idea. I think this whole cap and trade concept that's being understood around carbon being applied to polluters.
Getting traction for at least another year ago.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, we're going to keep a couple questions moving, so if you go quickly.
Sure. In an urban environment, about the trade-off between quantity of space that can be dedicated to open space and habitat versus issues of density and also the quality of that space. I work primarily in infill situations, so I rarely have very much land to work with. I'm wondering what the best strategies are with that.
Great question.
Mm-hmm. I guess I can say a few words. I think that, it's a I think that you can't solve everything with one answer. I think it's got to be a multifaceted approach towards biodiversity within cities by having, Deb was talking about, larger patches as well as corridors linking in with our natural systems of waterways and vegetated spaces. But also I think that there's a huge amount of space in our urban environments that's completely underutilized, and that would be our rooftops and our facades that are extremely underutilized. And then it's a matter of, again, getting the right amounts of soil so that it's actually a functioning ecological section rather than just a thin piece of turf. But I would say that would be one strategy.
Mm-hmm. And I think the green factor is a good example, and that came out of where you can do more vertical vegetation rather or rooftop vegetation versus horizontal. And I was struck by that idea came from Berlin, and then from Malmo, Sweden, has a development that has focused on that issue. And in Malmo, they have a whole I was so excited to go there and talk to the people that put together the ecological plan, because I thought about these habitat issues, and I'm like, oh, they're going to have all this data. It's going to be so exciting that how they determined. Well, it's culturally just accepted that that's a positive thing to do, so there isn't any data. And so, you know, we're just very data focused in the U.S. particularly, but you know, we want to sort of know why we're going to be what the numbers are, but anyhow, they're doing a lot of things: bat boxes, wildflower meadows, and that's all in the urban, in these small versions of those things.
Hmm. Wonderful, great question. Brad, did you have one? All right. Yeah. Any, because we can move to the next. Any, we can ask questions again later. Let's move. So, maybe just before we jump to that, let's do a quick little demographics here. How many landscape architects are there here? So we have a diverse. So what do we have? Urban planners, architects, engineers. Somebody else? Did I miss a demographic? Okay. Thank you. All right, so we got a public relations. Oh wow! So we got a nice group and spread out a little bit. So why don't we? I'm looking at sort of size of the tables here. I wonder if we had maybe four groups, and if this table wouldn't mind maybe dispersing to even those tables out, so we have four even groups. Does that mm-hmm. sound good? And then let's just review the challenge discussions. How can habitat quality be tied to the economic value? How can we engage animal behavior in our designs? And what are the obstacles and solutions to designing and managing adaptively? So how do we want to do this? Do we want to have everybody just have a 5-minute discussion about those questions? And we'll have the panelists come around and perhaps just... And then...
Maybe we'll do a report back at the end. You know, maybe each table could have a speaker. You know, have a speaker that wants to summarize for the group, and then we could go through and do five or ten minutes.
So your first order of business is convene and pick out your spokesperson, or well, maybe not. That's too hard. That usually comes naturally. You'll figure out who it is. So keep an eye on who that might be. all right. So let's. Maybe just have some dialogue between, and we'll get everybody's the panelists coming around and just working with you.